Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Nearly 20 months after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, questions are beginning to mount about the durability of Western support to Ukraine. Aside from cracks in Europe, such as the election of pro-Russian Prime Minister Robert Fico in Slovakia and increasingly contentious relations between Kyiv and Warsaw in the lead up to this weekend's elections in Poland, concerns have perhaps been greatest in the United States. Divisions within Congress have stalled the approval of additional assistance to Ukraine, with an ongoing leadership battle in the House of Representatives casting doubt on when legislators may finally be able to move forward on the issue. The horrific attack by Hamas on Israel adds further concerns about Washington's ability to remain focused on Ukraine. To discuss what these developments mean for the West's commitment to supporting Ukraine through what appears to be a long war, we're pleased to have Molly Reynolds and Max Bergman with us on the podcast. Welcome, Molly and Max.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Brief introductions. Molly Reynolds is a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She studies the U.S. Congress with an emphasis on how congressional rules and procedure affect domestic policy outcomes. And Max is the director of the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. From 2011 to 2017, he served in the U.S. Department of State in a number of different positions, including as a member of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff. All right, Molly, you are the Congress whisperer, the interpreter. Enlighten us on what is happening in the U.S. Congress, and maybe we can rewind a little bit and start with the continuing resolution that passed without funding for Ukraine. Can you explain how that happened and how we should interpret it? Is it a sign of waning support in the U.S. Congress for Ukraine, or was this as much about kind of procedural stuff?
Sure. It's been quite a 2 weeks in the U.S. Congress. And so to take everyone back to September 30th.
Which feels like a long time ago.
It does. It does. And none of us have been sitting through interminable meetings of the House Republican Conference. So I guarantee they also feel like it's been a long 2 weeks. So in to sort of rewind and remind everyone of where we were 2 weeks ago, the federal fiscal year begins on October 1st. And if Congress does not take action to approve at least a temporary spending bill, what we call a continuing resolution, because it just keeps funding generally the same at previous levels for most discretionary programs. If Congress doesn't do that, by the start of the new fiscal year, then we're facing the possibility of a government shutdown. And when the House and the Senate, both between the two chambers and within the two chambers, were having their debates over what would a continuing resolution look like that might be able to get through both chambers in order to avoid a government shutdown, there was this big open question of whether that continuing resolution would contain any aid for Ukraine. And the ultimate resolution was that on the middle of the day on a Saturday, which is obviously not an unusual time for Congress to be acting, Republicans in the House brought to the floor a continuing resolution that would keep the government open, but did not have any aid for Ukraine in it. They brought it to the floor under a procedure that meant that in order to clear the House, it was going to need to get 2/3 of the votes of the House, which is unusual for the House. Usually things that of this magnitude that come to the floor in the House do so under a set of procedures such that it's a simple majority vote, but there's kind of an expedited, more fast process that you can use, but it takes 2/3. And so there's this question about, you know, did then Speaker Kevin McCarthy kind of think that Democrats in the House were going to vote no on a continuing resolution that lacked aid for Ukraine? And I think there's some possibility that he thought that's what was going to happen. And then he was going to be able to pin a government shutdown on the Democrats and say, look, they Democrats care more about Ukraine than they care about the American people, et cetera. But that's not what happened. They passed the continuing resolution. It went over to the Senate, where Leader McConnell, who has been probably the Senate Republican Conference's most vocal one of its most vocal proponents of continued high levels of support for Ukraine, got rolled basically by his own conference. There was a lot of pressure on him to just go along with this continuing resolution that didn't have funding for Ukraine. So that's kind of how we got there. You asked about waning congressional support. Certainly in the House, the trend line is not in the right direction. So if we kind of look at a series of votes over time that the House has taken on aid to Ukraine, over the summer, when the House considered the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act of the summer, an amendment to prohibit security assistance to Ukraine outright, got 70 Republican votes. One to strike $300 million of funding, got 89 Republican votes. In the past couple of weeks, you've gotten 117 House Republican votes against Ukraine aid. So it's not going in the right direction. And then in the Senate, I think there's just a big open question about both kind of where the center of gravity in that conference is and what is the level of importance to the conference and continuing to push for this. And I'm sure we're going to talk about sort of what forms legislatively this could take in the coming months. But that's kind of my take on where we were, how we got here, and where we are right now.
Yeah, definitely going to get back to where we go from here in terms of legislative action. But before we do that, Max, in the absence of additional funding and an additional move in Congress to sustain the funding, where does that leave Ukraine? Like, what is the current state? How much money is left for Ukraine without that new resolution or a new bill?
So it's Ukraine would be in dire straits. Folks may have seen the story back in June of a Pentagon accounting error when it came to presidential drawdown authority. I'll describe what that is. But effectively, the Pentagon sort of found roughly $6 billion more. Now, you might be like, oh, how did they find money in the couch cushions? Well, actually, it's fairly explicable because, you know, how much is how much are DPICMs worth, right? Cluster munitions that are aging, that we're never going to provide to any other country, that we're not going to use ourselves. What is the value of that? Like, you know, I don't know. There's some bean counter in the Pentagon that has to assess, put a value on that. And I think what happened is the Pentagon, in part to stretch probably their budget, and this is my guess, went back and was like, actually, that value is not worth that. And there's no like market for these things. I guess there is a potential black market, but really, so that's understandable. So there was essentially more, there's now roughly $5 to $6 billion that the Pentagon has left over from the previous fiscal year. And this current sort of spend rate of presidential drawdown authority for Ukraine is about $2.5 billion a month. And this is, so that basically gets you to like Christmas, and then it stops. Like, it stops. And I think what people have to realize is the president doesn't have a magic wand that he can just wave to say, here, I'm going to give all this equipment to Ukraine. And I think this is, frankly, part of the issue with F-16s and other systems as well, is that there's, you know, the Pentagon is in the U.S. government are very strict about when we give U.S. equipment away. Congress has paid for that equipment. And so the president doesn't have a lot of authority to just give equipment away. And so what this thing, presidential drawdown authority, now normally presidential drawdown authority is valued at $100 million a year. That means every year the president could, you know, there would be a crisis. The president would say, okay, let's, you know, we'll take equipment from the Pentagon stocks. So this is basically just opening DOD's warehouses and say, Lebanon needs body armor. going to take body armor, put it on a plane, send it to the Lebanese Armed Forces. And when I was at the State Department, when I worked in the Bureau of Political and Military Affairs and then helped oversee it, you know, there was always a question of when do we use this drawdown authority throughout the fiscal year? Because there isn't that much money. So what Congress did is made that $14.5 billion, so a huge number that we could directly, with sort of an IV drip from U.S. stocks of munitions and other things, directly to the Ukrainian front lines. Well, that just reset as of October 1st to $100 million. So it's like basically gone. And then you could say, well, there's, you know, the Pentagon can find billions in the couch cushion, and Jim can talk about this, and that's true. And the one good thing is that there's, you know, supportive of the authorizing and appropriating committees in the House and Senate are pro-Ukraine. So if the Pentagon came and said, you know what, we want to allocate a few, you know, $10 billion and we're going to stop producing this system, or we're going to move money from here to pay for Ukraine, I think it would gain support. Now, there's two problems. One, bureaucratically, that's very hard because there's a clear bureaucratic loser. Someone's not getting their funding, and that creates lots of pushback. The second problem is that the security assistance funding, Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, the foreign military financing, which is at the State Department, states security assistance, you have to buy it. You can't just take it from the U.S. military. So you have to go to defense companies and say, we would like to buy air defense interceptors for Ukraine as fast as you can get them. Now, the way our defense industry works is not like Amazon. It's not like you just put an order and then tomorrow it shows up. It's like, oh, long lead time. They'll be like, well, in 2026, we'll get you your air interceptors. The problem is that Ukraine is about to be pummeled by Russian missile and drone attacks. And so the way we were resupplying is through drawdown authority, and we won't have that authority. So the implications of this are actually incredibly stark, incredibly dire. And I think if Congress doesn't get its act together here, a lot of Ukrainian civilians, women and children, are going to die. And that's actually going to have a direct political, you know, you can point to who caused this. Yes, it's Vladimir Putin caused this. But why doesn't Ukraine have the air defense? Well, House Republicans couldn't get their act together to pass this. And so I think this right now, you know, I think politicians are not great at looking around the corner. But the stakes here are really high.
So one other thing to add here, and I bet Max or someone else could do a better job of explaining the mechanics of this, is that when there were the continuing resolution was getting drafted and it was clear that it was going to move without additional funding for Ukraine, there were reports that there was a sort of side agreement that they would have a very quick vote in the House and then in the Senate on transfer authority for the executive branch that would, as I understand it, sort of help backstop some of this. And again, I'm curious for others to explain this. That got massively derailed by the ensuing crisis over the Speaker of the House. So I only sort of talked through what happened on Saturday the 30th. And then by the beginning part of the following week, for the first time in American history, the House of Representatives removed a speaker via a procedural move from the floor. And we are, as of this recording, still without a permanent Speaker of the House. And we can talk
over
about
to you, Molly. Yeah, talk about it. So what in the world is going on? And now that McCarthy is out, are the prospects of getting additional funding on Ukraine more dim and dismal than they were when McCarthy was there? And if you can do a little bit of the horse racing in terms of where you think the tide is going on who the future speaker is, and how much you think that matters. How much does it matter who the speaker is in terms of sustaining support for Ukraine?
Yeah. A lot of questions there. So
I think there's a lot of questions out there.
So we'll start with basically, so there's sort of a series of, how should I put this? Sort of a series of time horizons over which to ask these questions. So there's a very immediate question about to what degree can the House of Representatives do anything at this moment without a permanently elected speaker. This is a, without going like too far into the procedural weeds, this is a matter of some debate among people like me who spend too much of their time thinking about the rules of the House of Representatives. But what over the past 10 days, Patrick McHenry, who is acting as the speaker pro tem in the absence of an elected speaker, has basically taken the position that he cannot move legislation on the floor of the House, that that is not one of the powers that he has as the speaker pro tem. He ascended to becoming the speaker pro tem as the result of a rule in the House that was adopted after September 11th as a continuity reform out of concern that we could, you know, be attacked and the speaker could be dead or incapacitated. And you would want someone with some power to effectuate the selection and the election of a new speaker. The longer we go without House Republicans being able to coalesce around a candidate who can get 217 votes to be the next Speaker of the House on the floor, the less sustainable sort of this interpretation of the rules is. And so I suspect that if we get like into some time next week and the Republicans don't yet have a full speaker, then we'll start to see sort of McHenry be granted some additional powers there are a number of ways the House could do this. I won't get into them, but that basically to get out of where we are right now, which is this sense that the House cannot do anything. From there, the question is like, when does the House select a new speaker? Right now, this could be literally changing as I say this, but right now, Jim Jordan is running for speaker. It is unclear if he can get 217 votes on the floor of the House. It is frankly unclear whether he can get a majority of the conference within the conference to vote for him as the nominee to go to the floor. I think for anyone who is going to be the next Speaker of the House, frankly, if Kevin McCarthy were still the Speaker of the House, the growing opposition in the House Republican Conference, I should say, for some it's outright opposition, for some it's just more skepticism of additional assistance for Ukraine, that was going to be harder for anyone. It was going to be harder for McCarthy after events of September. It's certainly going to be harder for anyone else who ascends to the chair. And to the degree that I think certainly before McCarthy's ouster, my kind of working assumption was that if there was additional aid to Ukraine to come from Congress in the balance of this calendar year, it was going to come as part of an overall resolution to the spending fights for the year. The process of getting to that resolution on funding for everything has also gotten a lot harder by the fact that some House Republicans were willing to boot Kevin McCarthy from the speakership in part over how he is handling the overall discretionary appropriations process. So I think like the bottom line is it was like what happened before they got rid of McCarthy was going to make additional aid for Ukraine harder. And then everything that's happened since then also makes it harder.
There was kind of this line out there that if you could just get a vote to the floor, that it would pass. And the issue is just getting the vote to happen. Is that still the case or has that shifted?
I tend to think that's still the case. And I think I am generally, again, not to go too far into the congressional procedure weeds, I'm generally skeptical of what we call a discharge petition, which is this mechanism for getting a bill to the floor. It has a lot of procedural hurdles, but it's a way to get something to the floor without having to go through what's called the House Rules Committee, which is a committee that's sort of the traffic cop for what comes to the floor and what doesn't come to the floor. That committee has an overrepresentation of members of the majority party. And so it's basically like if the majority party doesn't want something to happen, it can't happen. A discharge petition is a way around that. I'm generally skeptical of discharge petitions. I'm sort of coming around to the idea that maybe that would be a way that like aid for Ukraine might actually be the kind of thing where we could see a successful discharge effort, because there is, like, while the skepticism to opposition in the conference is growing, it is not, there is still support from a sizable block of the House Republican Conference for assistance, as well as obviously from the Democratic caucus. Same is true in the Senate. Skepticism is sort of growing. McConnell, for a whole host of reasons, is being, his powers are weakening. But I think that if something came to the floor of the Senate, it would also pass there.
Thank you both very much. And Molly, thank you for all of that insight there on the Hill. Just to add that Gaza has certainly thrown a supercharge into those discussions, because it's not just aid for Ukraine. The idea is maybe bundling together aid to Israel because of Gaza, as well as aid to the border. I heard that this morning, and then Ukraine in there as well. So they make something for everyone, as usually gets legislation done. And so I think certainly the bottom line of how much they're going to request is going to be really big. If you have Ukraine in there, particularly in the amount that they're going to need to sustain the slowdown that we're entering into, but plus what the Israelis want, which I'm not sure what that bill will look like, and then the border as well. So just the amount is going to add to the politics of it, too, as eyes widen to what we're asking and where that money is going to come from, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So looking forward to seeing that. But let me ask you a quick question on the idea of Ukraine assistance not being in the CR. I mean, certainly there were tactics involved with that, but in terms of a real impact on Ukraine assistance, I mean, to me, and I might have this totally wrong, that while the CR didn't have assistance for Ukraine, let's assume, and this is probably a bad assumption, but let's assume by the end of this CR, they're going to have a bill that can pass in terms of funding the government. There could be Ukraine funding in that. So really what we're talking about is a gap of this during the CR period where there's no funding for Ukraine. But when that CR period is over and a bill is finally agreed, assuming the politics work, there could be funding in there. So people shouldn't think, oh, my goodness, no funding in the CR. That's terrible. Well, that's for us a certain period of time, a short period of time. That funding can be restored when they have the final bill. I mean, this is all theoretical. I mean, maybe the politics are such that not even in the final bill is there going to be Ukraine funding. But just making that point that was a tactical move rather than and an alarming one, because that's a sharp tactic to use and not a good sign that they would use that as a tactic. But at the end of the day, its impact really was for that period of time of the CR, and then that the funding could be restored once a bill was passed to fund the government. Am I right on that, or am I just totally wrong?
So I'll defer to Max on sort of the like substantive real world on the ground consequences of any sort of gap in the flow of funds. As a sort of political matter in the House, I think there are two things to think about. One is the possibility that given the level of dysfunction in the House Republican Conference, we actually are ultimately unable to get to an omnibus spending package right. that could have right. additional funds and end up with a CR for the duration of the calendar year, the duration of the fiscal year. That would be quite bad for a whole host of reasons.
That's terrible, absolutely.
Including the prospects of aid to Ukraine, but to lots of other things that listeners to this podcast care deeply about, including the overall defense budget and all kinds of other federal programs. Right. Domestically and abroad. So I think that I don't know how likely that is as a resolution to this, but I think we should always keep that in mind as a possibility. The other question is that even if we do get to the point where Democrats and Republicans in the two chambers are able to negotiate their way to a mutually acceptable omnibus bill, I don't know at what point sort of additional aid to Ukraine becomes a big enough sticking point that it's the sort of thing that has to come out because the it is jeopardizing the ability to get the overall package done. It's obviously like it's obviously very salient. It was a very, very salient part of the debate over the CR. I don't have a great sense of whether that might be true with the omnibus, but I think that's also something just to keep in mind. But then I will send things over to Max.
You know, yeah, that's no. Oh, just a real quick. No, that's exactly the nightmare scenario, is if the politics turn to such a degree that they can't get Ukraine funding in the omnibus. And then that's a problem. That's a big problem. That's a nightmare scenario. But yes, Max.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have to remember it's not just about the money. It's also about the authorization on drawdown authority to increase that back up to a big number. Now, the good news there is, well, that doesn't have to go to Ukraine, right? So that's just sort of a global amount. And you could see some fudging. Well, you know, we're just going to increase the, you know, broader DOD state security assistance budgets by, you know, $50 billion when they're, you know, roughly 10 or around 10 to 15.
I would faint if they did that.
Yeah, right. But that's sort of what we've been doing through supplemental appropriations. So I think you could see some ways for everyone to get like creative about it. I guess maybe I slightly disagree with Molly a little bit on the politics of this. I think in general, what's happened is that I think there's really strong bipartisan support for this. I think there's a lot of Republicans that really want to get this done. And it is a big priority. I also think that everyone was sort of a little bit sleepwalking into this whole fight, right? We sort of woke up on October 1st. And the government magically wasn't shut down, yay, but then suddenly Ukraine wasn't funded. But I think Congress sort of thought, or many Republicans in the Senate and others, that there's such strong bipartisan support that this will just happen, it'll be part of the budget deal. And part of the White House's strategy here was to try to make this sort of in bite-sized chunks. So the request is for like $24 billion, which is just like not nearly enough to last for the whole, you know, through the whole next fiscal year. And the idea was, well, it's just, you know, it's small enough that that maybe this will just pass. It'll be routine, not a big deal. And, you know, there was a lot of theories in the press that was there a deal between Biden and McCarthy? No one has been able to approve this and I think McCarthy has denied it. But Biden himself had said, you know, hopes McCarthy keeps his word. And my sense here is that I think McCarthy wanted to get the Ukraine funding done sort of, you know, from a policy standpoint, but then recognized how toxic the politics were becoming, especially when you started to have a Republican primary debate that happened in August and members went home in August. And I think that sort of shifted the tenor. But in general, I think now what you will have is that the White House strategy is thrown out the window. That the new thing is that they need to put a huge bill on the table. And when it comes to linking Israel and Ukraine, you know, there's sort of a pushback on that. How dare you link these two? Well, Jim, you know, you were in the Pentagon post 9/11. I mean, how did our wars get funded? Through overseas contingency accounts funding that was supplementals, that was Iraq and Afghanistan, and then whatever else you wanted to throw in. So, you know, this isn't sort of a vehicle for a policy discussion. It's more, this is, you know, a supplemental funding package. So I think linking Israel and Ukraine makes a lot of sense. It perhaps could also provide the justification needed to Republicans that wanted a bit of cover on Ukraine, that support Ukraine, but wanted a bit of cover. But this then gets to the whole dilemma of, you know, and I was depressed by Molly sort of talking about the discharge petition, because that I've seen sort of on Twitter, and this is, you see this a lot about the discharge petition can save all on all sorts of things, you know, over the course of the years. But ultimately, right now, a Republican speaker would need to bring to the floor a piece of legislation that divides his party, and no speakers really want to do that. But that said, like, that's going to be true with funding the government as well. So I don't know how to get this through. The one additional point here is that while the CR, the continuing resolution that was done to get us to sort of, I think it's mid-November, until the government potentially shuts down. On the one hand, is, you know, good news, U.S. government's still working, you never want to shut down. On the other hand, you know, after that, like, Ukraine will have about a month left of potential funding that it can use. So if the government shuts down, and normally in Washington, the government shuts down, it lasts like, you know, a few weeks, maybe towards a month, and then everyone gets their kind of like heads together and passes stuff. Well, at that point, we would be in December. Ukraine will be running out of money. And just think about if you're planning a war, if you're on the ground and you're, you know, a general, and are you going on the counteroffensive, or should Ukraine right now pull back because they don't know if they're going to have the ammo coming to them in January? Real operational questions that are, you know, put Ukrainians in a really tough spot.
That's the point I wanted to make. And Andrea, you've been very patient with me to ask a follow-up here, but it's a, you know, the funding and the politics and this type of thing, the games on the Hill, that's one thing. But how this plays out on the ground is something else. As you're trying to plan a winter offensive, you know, Zelensky said he's going to fight during the winter, and I'm sure he will give it his best shot. But one thing that is concerning is if with Gaza, you know, the Israelis said that they, at least the initial report was that they needed air defense, artillery, and artillery ammunition. Well, that's what Zelensky needs too. And we already know we're under quite a bit of stress in our own drawdown for our own stocks. Because, you know, Max, as you said, if we say, well, okay, well, we'll go out and we'll get contracts for some more artillery and this type of thing, that's not coming anytime soon. So if a lot of this is out of hide, and with Israel now adding to the demand, that's my concern. Money or not money, that's one thing. It's just the ability now to provide the goods on a timely basis so these guys can plan. And this is where I think, too, the European allies have got to come in and help fill these gaps. We can't wait to the last minute, I think, in Europe, as the European allies are watching this unfold in Washington. They can't just watch. They're going to need to help us hedge. So that when we turn to them, maybe in 3 months or so, and say, we can't deliver 155 millimeter except for three more months of it, they've got to fill that gap. And they can't wait to be told. They need to get things underway now. And I don't know, that depresses me, but I'll get off.
It is a dark picture. I mean, so there's a political will question, and then there's a sheer kind of capacity in the industrial production capability.
Right.
And that, like, as Max, you're making the point, I mean, a lot of the stuff now, the contracts are in, but that might not come for 12 to 14 months. And so for really looking at 2024, it's kind of a gloomy picture for Ukraine. There's not going to be a resurgence of stuff because they've already burned through a lot of the things that we had given them in the lead up to the counteroffensive. So, I mean, I think that's the dark picture. But to Jim's point, Max, to what extent do you think that has sunken in with the European allies? And looking at the defense ministers meeting that they just held, I guess, was it yesterday or the day before? Yeah. Were there any positive signs coming out of there, or does it add to the worry?
Well, I know European officials have sort of been tracking what's happening on the Hill very closely. And I think there's sort of two different attitudes. One of just confidence, oh, the Americans will figure this out. And I think that's in part because the administration, I think, has sort of made a tactical mistake over the last year in really reassuring our European partners that a new Republican Congress was, you know, fully supportive, bipartisan support, Ukraine funding was going to happen. I mean, to me, when Kevin McCarthy struggled to become Speaker in January, it immediately was like, my God, this is going to be a challenge. I actually wrote a piece in War on the Rocks in March of this year that was like, security assistance could get really complicated because of this dilemma of him bringing the bill to the floor. But we were reassuring Europeans. Now, the problem for Europe is, like, they open their warehouses and they're looking in and there's not much in there. So they don't have the depth of reserves that we have. And so their ability to sort of backfill that urgent resupply is very limited. Now, they're doing a lot on the defense industrial side. They should probably be doing more. We should be encouraging them to do more. But it looks like their, you know, defense industrial production is now going to sort of start to ramp up, but that might not be to the later half of 2024. What I would say here is that I think what we need to probably do is encourage our European partners to cut into their bone, to cut into the bone a little bit more. So, you know, you'll have military officers in Europe that will say, well, our, you know, we already don't have supplies, so we're not going to cut our readiness anymore. And I think the politicians need to say, yes, you are. One thing we could do, and Jim knows about it, we could, you know, reassure our European partners by deploying forces. That's something the president could do. So if, you know, Europeans are going to start giving away their brand new shiny kit because that's all they have left, well, we can, you know, put forces in Europe to then reassure them as they have drawn down even further. One quick point on Israel.
But Matt, that gets complicated by the Middle East too. I mean, like really you start running into this.
So the one thing I would say about the Israelis, and I could be wrong here, but I think there's definitely going to be some overlap of Israeli needs and Ukrainian needs. And so, you know, what we want the Israelis to be doing, if they're going to be striking in Gaza, is to be striking with precision. That isn't really 155 millimeter rounds, which then would turn Gaza into Bakhmut. And I think that that's, and so that isn't necessarily the munition that, that the Israelis are desperate for. Unless something has changed, I could be wrong there. I think a lot of it is more precision guided munitions, that frankly, you know, because of our security assistance of $3.5 billion a year, the Israelis have stockpiles of. They are ready for war. And when it comes to the air interceptors, a lot of those are Iron Dome. Ukraine doesn't have Iron Dome. There could be need for Patriot and other things like that, that then create a degree of overlap. My assumption here is that Israel and Ukraine aren't really getting in each other's way, and that we have enough to do both, and that I don't think they should be seen as stealing one from the other. Also, just given the vast stockpiles that Israel has on hand.
Molly, go ahead, Jim, first.
Just real quick on the stockpiles with what Max just said. Something interesting, Max is right. The U.S. has had, I think, like 5 stockpiles within Israel of ammunition and assistance that's pre-positioned in Israel. We've already sent a lot of that to Ukraine.
Yeah.
And this was before Gaza. So it shows you how shit happens. Sorry for the language to the listeners, but in this case, shit happened. And the stuff we had set aside in Israel for an emergency, a lot of it was already used for Ukraine. It shows you the depth of the problem. But sorry to interrupt.
And it depends on how the conflict evolves. I mean, and if it widens in any way, then I think we're talking about something differently. But Molly, from like a legislative perspective, what is the impact of the Hamas attack on Israel for the Ukraine funding? Does it complicate it? Does it make it harder? I guess I don't know how to think about it. Is it a good thing? I mean, you kind of answered this a little bit, but just to come back to it, is it a useful thing for Ukraine in a perverse way? Because, like, as someone was saying, maybe somewhat reluctant Republicans can use the cover of Israel if Ukraine is attached to it. Are the Republicans going to totally balk and say, no way, we're not going to link these two things, we want to vote on them separately? Kind of from a legislative perspective, what has the conflict in the Middle East done to the Ukraine funding bit?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's sort of one universe where it is the ability to link the two issues together could be helpful for getting Ukraine assistance across the finish line. So this would be a very sort of classic, like, legislative log roll. You have a group of members, as Max pointed out, a large bipartisan group of members who care a lot about aid for Ukraine. You have an even larger bipartisan group of members who care about additional support for Israel. Could you put the two things together and get across the finish line? I think that there's certainly a world where that's true. You've seen a little bit of reporting that tries to sort of throw a little bit of cold water on that plan or possibility. I don't entirely know what to make of it. I can't emphasize how fluid everything is at this moment in terms of, like, the coming future of the House. And, you know, if and when the House Republicans resolve the speakership question, exactly what they're under pressure to deal with first, again, we have sort of in the background, as I think everyone has pointed out, the looming need to do something to avoid a government shutdown in the middle of November. That's a whole complicated question. And so how much does that take precedence over trying to build a coalition on additional security assistance of various kinds? I just don't know. But I do think there is a world where sort of uniting the two issues together in a supplemental is productive for getting it across the finish line. There's also a world where just sort of congressional politics on Israel alone dwarf the sort of questions of how to resolve the congressional politics on Ukraine. And there's just a lot of pressure to move very fast, sort of as fast as possible and as needed on aid to Israel.
Yeah, the thing I was, Max, just to come back to you on, we haven't talked about U.S. public opinion, and then I want to tie this to Europe in a second, but, you know, to what extent is the negative trajectory that Molly painted linked to American views on sustaining support for Ukraine? Because that, too, is moving in the wrong direction. And the thing that, you know, I'm thinking about the Israel war, too, and how this might intersect with Ukraine. And I was just remembering that President, you know, after the continuing resolution passed with no support for Ukraine, President Biden, or there was news that President Biden was going to give a major address on Ukraine. Well, then the Hamas attack happened and that has been swept aside. And I don't know where that stands anymore. And so, you know, that was going to be an opportunity for President Biden to make the case for to the American public about why Ukraine matters, and now it doesn't. So I know, wrapped up in there is just kind of your sense of where American views and attitudes are and what the appetite is in the United States to sustain the support.
So, you know, I actually think the support publicly is really strong. It's still above 50%, and above 50% for foreign aid is very high in any U.S. context. I just think that we've also gotten, you know, the wars, we're now, you know, it's been going on for a year and a half. Public's a little bit less focused on it. And then you have a sizable portion of the Republican Party now arguing against it, which then, you know, because of our polarized environment, has shifted public opinion. I do think that also what the White House was doing, what the president was not trying to politicize Ukraine aid and not trying to politicize Ukraine. And, you know, most of the criticism that was happening over Ukraine aid was happening toward the Biden administration being too slow, not doing enough and not providing enough. But the Biden administration wasn't ever really hitting House Republicans and for holding up Ukraine aid. I think that will shift. And I think the politics of this, you know, the president's first ad of this cycle was him going to Kyiv. And part of the larger message is that the kind of MAGA Trump wing is very extreme. And I think part of what we're seeing in the Republican Party is we're getting closer to a Republican primary, you know, political cycle. Trump looks like the nominee. House Republicans don't really want to be on the wrong side of Trump. Yet I think the message that can really be delivered by the president, especially if Russian missiles are striking, you know, Ukrainian hospitals, and the Ukrainians aren't able to defend their cities because, you know, House Republicans didn't want to pass a Ukraine funding bill. Well, I think the ad's right itself that, you know, House Republicans are siding with Vladimir Putin in his war, and, you know, you can take it in whatever political direction you get. But when there's real sort of carnage at the end of this and real consequences, I actually think that, you know, like, what side are you standing on here? And we haven't seen that from the administration really pushing that, in part because they were playing a quiet game with the Hill that they thought was the right strategy. And I think if the funding stops, there will be a massive political push by, at least I would hope there would be, to extract real political costs on those that have blocked funding for a country fighting against one of our major adversaries and fighting for its freedom. I mean, I think the ads write itself, Reagan, freedom, Russia, like, I think there's going to be a political cost to this if the political consultant strategists decide to make it. I think this could really be, could backfire on Republicans politically, but that's, you know, I'm biased because I'm, you know, want this funding to be passed, and you know, political consultants would say foreign policy never really factors in. yes and no. I think the carnage that you can point to would have an impact.
Okay, two final speed questions, one for each of you, Max. So we've had what's happened in the United States, and as I teased in the intro, we also had in very close proximity the elections in Slovakia that brought an anti-Ukraine kind of foreign minister to power there. We've had the uptick in tensions between Poland and Kyiv in the run-up to Poland's election there. You had the AfD doing surprisingly well in some regional elections in Germany. To what extent should we be connecting these dots and should we be worried? And then Molly, my last question to you is, when will we have a speaker? But Max and then Molly.
So I mean, that's a huge question, Andrea.
Quick thoughts.
So I would say, I think we're overstating the connections here. I mean, they're like the Slovakian election where, you know, he wins by 24% of the vote and the coalition dynamics. I think what's really happening is just the effects of the war in terms of inflation, in terms of other things, are starting to have an impact on some of the governments that were in power. But I think what's actually remarkable is how steadfast European governments, whether that's Spain or Finland, have been in support of Ukraine. I think we'll do a lot. The one other thing, just a final thought, which isn't related to your question, is I think the one thing I should say is people are going to work really hard inside the US government. They're going to look at every authority. They're going to get their, you know, they're going to bring their lawyers, you know, the State Department, DOD lawyers, and say, let's look at this authority. Can we, you know, can we expand this? Did Congress mess up in writing the rules? Because Congress tries to write these things so that, no, you can't, there isn't a lot of leeway. And I think people are going to really work really hard. And it reminds me of the movie Darkest Hour, when FDR calls Winston Churchill and is like, sorry, we can't really provide you aid. But what we can do is we're going to bring a bunch of planes to the border and we can get a horse to like pull them across. And Churchill sort of takes the phone and puts it to his chest. Now that sucks. Like, we don't want to be in that position. But even if the funding doesn't happen, and this isn't good, I don't want to have people feeling okay at the end of this, we will still try to figure out ways to get stuff to Ukraine. It's just not going to be anywhere near what is needed for Ukraine to really sustain the current offensive or the war effort. It would really alter a lot of what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, heaven forbid anyone feels good about anything these days, right? But okay, right. Molly, when are we going to have a speaker?
Max got off with the easy speed question. I don't know. I do think that if we get into next week without any clarity on sort of the election of a regular full speaker, we will start to see even more conversations about sort of the various ways that Mr. McHenry could be empowered in his role as the acting speaker pro tem, so the House could start doing more things than it's currently doing under the interpretation of his powers under the rules. So I think that I feel comfortable saying that if we get into next week, we're going to start seeing a lot more pressure for them to kind of figure out how to start doing things again. As to when we have an actual speaker, like, it could be by the time someone's listening to this, or it could be next week late. I don't even know at this point.
Any chance McCarthy comes back?
At this point, anything is possible. Like, I spent a fair amount of time over the past couple of weeks telling people that rarely are things truly unprecedented in the United States Congress. Like, there's very rarely new things under the sun, but we've never seen them successfully depose someone from the floor using a motion to vacate the chair. We've never seen someone ascend to being speaker pro tem as a result of this particular provision of the House rules. We are in truly unprecedented territory.
So what you're saying is that Trump could become a speaker of the House. Anything can happen, and he might just show up there, gavel in hand, and we're off to the races.
This was amazing. Thank you both for this. It's complicated, it's complex, and appreciate you guys bringing so much knowledge and insight to these issues. I think it's really helpful, certainly for me, but probably lots of listeners as well. So thank you, and hope to have you guys back soon.
Yeah,
my
thank
pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Brussels Sprouts, brought to you by the Transatlantic Security Team at the Center for a New American Security. You can find all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And please remember to rate and review Brussels Sprouts so that new listeners are able to find the show.